Dargrave Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn Semester 2009, this is Business Finance FIL 240, Section 6. Lecture 8, delivered on September 10, 2009. The title of this lecture is Financial Statements and Their Analysis.
Today, Financial Statements and Their Analysis. Now, I'm going to have to do something here, and I will apologize beforehand for offending those who might be offended, who very well will be offended. You, sir, are a cow. Yes, you're a cow. A beautiful creature. A creature that has hopes and dreams, but from a visual perspective, you're just absolutely amazing. This big bovine animal walking along through the fields, frolicking, eating, defecating even. Now, you're majoring in accounting, right? By the way, note that I learned long ago to use one of the males in the class to say you are a cow. 20 years ago, I just plowed it. You're a cow. And I thought, oh God, I'm going to die right now. You are God. How do I know that? You're an accountant. You put together this beautiful creature of nature. Perfect in every respect. Everything perfectly fitting together inside that cowhide. Everything serving a purpose to the benefit of the cow as a living thing. Indeed, every last piece of that has a reason, has a purpose to the functioning of the whole, which is the cow. I am Al. I'm a butcher. I run Al's Butcher Shop and Financial Consulting Firm. There used to be a Baptist reading room attached, but I spun that off. Not in the core business model. Now, you, madam, come to me and say, I should like 3 or 4 steaks. How many? 4. What kind? Ribeyes. Good. And then you come in and say, I should like some ground beef. Good. And then you would come in and say, I would like a big round rump. And I say, indeed. And then you say, wait, wait, if she's going to order the rump, I'd like some mountain cherries. Dear God. So here I am. I've got orders coming in. And so I say, come here, sweet cow. Come here. Here, sweetie. And, of course, I apply the electrical thing. And you die. And I take this beautiful creature that is God's work, perfect in so many ways, and I cut it up. I cut off a couple of steaks. I pull out some side meat and grind it up for the... And then, of course, I take the rump and I walk like that. And I go, and the mountain chairs, we won't get into that. But mind you, do you see what I am doing as a financial analyst? I am carving up what has been created by someone else. You created something following the rules that had purpose, and it was perfect in every respect for what you wanted. For me, though, I have a consumer audience. I'm sorry, a consumer group. And they have different needs for the parts of this thing. I didn't put you together, but I sure cut you up. And that is what financial analysis is all about. Quite literally, we take what has been created and we carve it into parts that are for different information constituencies, different information consumers. We might do liquidity ratios for banks that are providing working capital loans. We might do deeper kinds of technical analysis for investors who are in long-term investment, looking for long-term investments. We do all kinds of different things for different people, but we always start with a cow, which is the financial statements, which have been put together for the purposes of reporting. What we do with that after that, and that's where it gets very important. What I do with this cow is none of your business. You are the god of cows. I don't report to you. I'm a butcher. I report to the god of butchers. And the butcher says, cut him up, sell him. There you go. So that's how this begins. And I promise you, you will never hear that way of describing it in any other finance class you will ever take again. Guaranteed. Here's the deal. And the way I do this, I mean, I'm going to do the technical, well, you do this divided by this, or you subtract that from that. But the first thing that a financial analyst does when we get into this is I take these financial statements and I just look at them. I survey the number scape. What's the scale of the numbers? What are the sizes involved? What kinds of, do I see negative signs down low? That worries the hell out of me if I see negative signs down low. I just survey the landscape of these. I don't attack right away. I toy with the cow. I tell the cow that we're going to go out to eat. In fact, you know, have you ever had Kobe beef? It's Kobe beef is from Japan. It's extremely good and tender. They treat the cows incredibly well. They their whole lives. In fact, you know how they kill those cows? They take them to Kabuki theater and bore them to death. Mm-hmm. Yes. Where the hell was I? But you see, what I'm going to do is I'm going to survey this. I'm just going to look at you. I'm going to study you because I need to know how best to approach this. Now, there are technical rules how we do it. We go boom, boom, boom. But before we do this, we look at the financial statements. Now, these are these are made up. Okay. But and they're simplified from the ones you can look at real financial statements and say, where the hell do I start on this? Where's the sales line? It's not quite that bad, but some of them can get really big and long. But when I look at this, I can say, okay, we've got a company. This last year we've got a report. It pulls $15 million in sales. Okay, well, what does that mean? It's a small company. Small company. Right off the bat, I know that's a small company. Now, obviously, I'm talking about the grand scheme of things. If for you starting out your business next year as a lawnmower service, $15,000 would be a big number for you. But in the grand scheme of companies, $15 million, oh, that's really small. We got a cost of goods sold of $5 million. Okay, we got essentially about a third of the revenues were burned up getting those revenues directly. Essentially, remember that the cost of goods sold tells us something about what was directly attributable to what was sold. So, okay, a third. What does that mean? We'd have to look at more financial statements to get a sense of what that means in context. But here, that's nothing unreasonable. That's okay. We're in business. We got a gross profit of $10 million. We got depreciation of $2 million. Well, that's a hefty depreciation on a $10 million gross profit. $2 million. Looks like some capital investment's been going on. Who knows? We'll look at that later. And we got sales and administrative expenses of $800,000. Well, they spent $800,000 to generate $10 million in sales, just objectively. And if you say something stupid, I won't even say that's stupid. But just in your judgment, what does that sound like? $800,000 to generate $10 million in sales, good or bad?
It doesn't sound too bad.
No, you're right. That's decent. I mean, geez, if I could have a business where I could make pull in $10 million in a gross profit, spending only $800,000, geez, I'd do that. That's not bad at all. Just, we'll see later as we look at more financial statements whether that is or not. Notice again, I'm trying to emphasize, this isn't soft and fluffy what I'm doing. I'm actually surveying for my attack. I'm just studying this thing. I'm not even really charging with a calculator. I just want to look at it for a minute. And I've had people who said, well, what do you see? What do you see? And I said, get off me for a while. Just let me look for what I look at this thing. And okay, well, we've got our EBIT is $7,200,000. Well, we're talking, that's not bad. I mean, geez, gross was $10 million, and you're still, by the time you get to EBIT, you're popping along at $7.2 million. Okay, we've got interest. No interest paid. Well, that's interesting. Okay, so we got our income before taxes. Let's see here. 2.3 divided by 7.2. What is it? About 30% tax bracket. That's average. That's not our marginal. That's our average. More important, remember, if you remember from economics, it's always the marginal that is what is really important, not the average. But here we can see that the average, and we could look at the tax tables to see what the marginal was on 7.2. But okay, about 32% they paid in taxes average. So we got net of 4.894 million on net sales of $15 million. Now I'm going to just grab the calculator very quickly. And if you have a calculator, just do it too. I'm going to take my net, 4.894. My margin, and that's the word I'll use, my margin is about 33%. Okay? 33%. Do you see that? I took what I had made at the bottom line divided by what I took in at the top line. Okay? That's my net margin. Okay, 33%. That will be all over the board. There is no golden number. It is very much dependent upon the industries. I've seen industries in the 60%. I've seen industries below 1%, and the companies were doing damn fine at below 1%. One of the famous things, stories years ago when oil companies were under a lot of heat because their profits had, because gas prices had skyrocketed, they went on TV with this ad and said, did you know that our profit on every dollar we sell is less than a penny? He held up a penny, and of course people say, really? They didn't believe it. No, you lying mofo. No, actually it is. It's very, very low margin. But of course, when you sell billions and billions and billions of dollars, you're still going to make a lot of money. So it's very dependent upon the industry. That's why when you do ratio analysis, you have to look at a comparison. What are the industry averages? You can't just say, well, that's good or that's bad. You have to say, okay, what's the industry like? But it's even worse than that. You might be in an industry where most of the companies suck. And so then you say, well, okay, it's right on the industry averages. Yeah, but this industry, the companies are dying in it. Uh-oh. So it's layered, your approach here. So that's why it's better to just look at things for a while before you start charging too much. Okay, they had dividends of $400,000. So that would be a dividend and net income ratio of about 10%. Notice how I'm trying to avoid as much as possible using the calculator. I'm just giving rules of thumb here. A little less than 10% of their money was put back in, was given to the shareholders. So it looks here like if the dividend payout was, if the payout was about 10%, that would mean that the plowback was about 90%. Now, this, again, I'm using language here and just hoping you catch on as I do it. Plowback, if the dividend payout ratio was about 10%, then the plowback was about 90%. Okay, you get that idea there. If the dividend ratio is about 10%, then the plowback would be about 90%, which says that this company believes that it has something good that it can do with 90% of its net. That's what this is telling me as an analyst and as an investment type of person. This company seems to believe that it can carry some good, better than its investors could by having the money back, with 90% of its money. Truth be told, if it's a really, really strong company, the question always arises, why is it giving any money back to the shareholders at all? The best understanding we have of that in finance is that a dividend is a signal. I can afford to give you some of this money back. I really could use it all and put it back into the company and make your stock price go up, but just to make sure you know that we're okay, I'll give you a little bit of money. We'll give you some of this money. And we'll hold that amount constant, and if we do better, we might pay you a little more, just to give you another signal we're doing better. If, God forbid, we should actually back down from what we're paying you as dividends, that would be a very bad sign for us. It would tell us if something has gone wrong, that we can't provide for you this nice candy to keep you happy anymore. And so we go to the balance sheet. And notice in that sidebar how I do the changes. That's going to be my food that will pump into the statement of cash flows. There's my sources and uses right there on the side for the 2 years comparatively. And I look here, okay, my cash went up by $1 million. Now, the statement of cash flows tells me how that happened. The statement of cash flows will tell me how that happened, how I came to have $1 million more in cash in the bank. And I'm walking down it. Okay, receivables went up. And that was actually a fairly dramatic rise. You see it went up $300,000 on $700,000 initially. Geez, that's what, 40% or so, something like that? Its receivables jumped a lot for that. So that tells me something right there. Again, notice, I'm not using the calculator anymore. I probably will once in a while here. But what I'm doing is I'm using visual observation. And it's not so much the numbers themselves as it is movements of numbers that are really important to me. I'm looking not at 700,000 or a million. I'm looking at what it means to go from 700,000 to a million. And in this case, 700,000 to a million, that's 3 divided by 7. That's a jump of 3 divided by 7. What the hell is 3 divided by 7? I could have done that myself, you see. 43%. I was close. That's a 43% jump in accounts receivable. That tells me something right there. Well, they're doing damn well, but they're selling a whole lot more, but are they selling a whole lot more because they're being so much more generous with their terms? Oh. So, you see, it's not just, our sales went up last year. Well, did you do something that sort of induced those sales to go up? That's fine, but we've got to take that into consideration because you put the company at greater risk by putting more of your cash on the back burner. Okay? So, it's a double-sided sword. Again, there's rarely great and horrible. There are these nuances. You have to ask a lot of questions. Walking down it, inventory. Oh, what happened? What happened? Talk to me. What did their inventory do? A little bit? Yeah. From 17.3 to 10? Really? Okay, good or bad, hard to say, but they definitely leaned out their inventory severely, seriously. Does that mean that they're going to some kind of just-in-time system or something like that? Or does that mean that they postponed replenishing their stock, their inventory stuff, and they're going to have a little bit of an issue if they don't knock it off with doing that down the road? Maybe they're just leaning out. They had so much warehouse space devoted to inventory that was sitting there on the shelves. They got smart and they started just selling down. On the other hand, maybe they were postponing inventory purchasing decisions for one reason or another. Perhaps we can get some view of that as we look further down in the financial statement. Talk to me, go.
Can I have one of those sheets, please?
I'm sorry, you can't. What the hell?
I was like, what is
that? I'm sorry, I'm looking right. Does anyone else need one? Okay, yeah, go ahead. You know, it's funny. I actually was thought about that myself. I was planning my lecture for this semester, and I was just I drove by one of the lots here in town. They had one of those signs up, and I was thinking, well, how would that affect this kind of a thing? Well, remember that those clunkers, they have to be ruined. After the place takes them in, it has to just get rid of them, dump them off. So my thought is, and I actually haven't looked at the financial statements, and I really would be kind of curious. I would think that obviously those would be zero to inventory. They'd just be sort of like something that they'd have to get rid of. And I'm wondering, do they have to pay to get rid of those, or is there some kind of a program to get rid of them?
They actually make like a little bit of money off of them.
Okay.
By selling them to scrap yards.
Okay.
But I figured like the accounts receivable would jump so high and the inventory would be...
Well, that was, as a matter of fact, there is a car dealer in town that I know one of the... sons, and he said that they tried to get in front of this with their inventory, their new car inventory for the trade-ins. He said, we tried to get in front of it. We were wiped out. So if you were to look at the financial statements on a snapshot-by-snapshot basis, you could see those things all over the place. One day they'd be in the tens of millions. Maybe a week later they would have been down to zero again or something very low. So there would have been a high degree of volatility. The one thing that's interesting, though, about that is that if you looked at year-end to year-end, you wouldn't see anything, right? Because it would have all been something that would have happened in the interim. And then if you looked at the two statements, you would have never seen that this happened at all. You might see revenues certainly have went through the roof. But as far as inventory at end of year 2008 versus end of year 2009, you wouldn't see anything happen because the program has, I believe the program has ended, hasn't it? Yeah, and so it's over. It's sort of like something that was incredible, but you don't have any evidence that it ever happened. It's sort of like seeing a UFO. I mean, you see it, but I mean, unless you have your camera handy and the UFO didn't suck you in and take you to another planet and experiment with you, you have no evidence. And even if it did, what are you going to say when they bring you back? Hey, dude, look at this scar. What the hell does that have to do with it? Sorry. I've had way too much coffee this morning. Let me walk through here. Marketable securities. Well, there's something interesting. Marketable securities went down by $1 million. Okay, so we got cash went up $1 million. Marketable securities went down $1 million. So really, in terms of absolute liquidity, money they could get their hands on real, real quick, their cash and their marketable securities, it really didn't move at all. Excuse me, move it all in that one. Now, let me walk on here just a minute. Okay, prepaid expenses. It doesn't look like anything happened there. Okay, now we get to something useful. Total current assets. 37 went to 30. Okay, now, go down real quick and look at the total current liabilities. 14 went to 9. Notice that both currents slid, which is an interesting thing. This company seems to have become less liquid. Now, that's actually not a bad sign. It would tell me if other things were indicating the same direction, maybe this is a company that is going into a maturing phase where it's essentially, it's getting its liquidity down It's no longer worried about being able to pay its bills for this month. And it's essentially putting up its fortresses around it with the fixed stuff. It's tilting towards the long term. It's beginning to tilt away from that short-term thinking that a newer, younger company might have. And it's beginning to put together those Spartan shields for the long march. I don't know, though. But you see, I'm trying to get you more to see how we think. What our kind of our way of looking at this is. There's definitely something dramatic happening here. Liquidity, currency of this company is beginning to evaporate. And it looks like it's moving towards more of a long-term posture. But we'll see that in the long term here. Okay, looking at the fixed assets, growth skyrocketed. Oh yeah, no doubt about it. This is a company that is throwing down stuff for the long haul. Right there, that tells me that. Now, what I want to know is there a matching going on? Are they financing this huge fixed asset growth with huge long-term debt? Going down now into the liabilities, let's look at the long-term debt. Yeah, it jumped. Jumped about 50%. Fixed assets jumped 100%. That worries me a little bit. That bothers me. Okay, do you see why that's not happy stuff? You see they grew 100% fixed assets, but it looks to me, at least as a first pass, that they did not use long-term money to do that. But we can now look down at the equity section. Well, let's see what happened with their equity. Common stock, capital in excess of par. They went from $13 million to $16 million. Okay, there's $4 million of it right, $3 million of it right there. You see that? They went from $13 to $16. There's $3 million of real long-haul stuff that came in to pay for this. And we've got, what was it, about $5 million of long-term stuff, about $4 million of long-term stuff. So that's $7 million of long-term stuff that I'm looking at right now that financed $14 million of fixed asset growth. I'm still not happy. That's not comfortable for me. Maybe I can see something that will convince me otherwise. I look over back over at the income statement. Okay, they pulled in $5 million net income. Okay, now I recognize, of course, that that's not cash, but we have a name sometimes in finance for the net income. We call it internally generated equity. Externally generated equity is when you essentially sell your stock to the public or to someone. Internally generated equity is what you got after you've paid your bills. That's the equity holder's stake in the company for the year. So it looks like they financed about maybe in the neighborhood $5 million, something like that. $5 million with internally generated equity. That's long haul stuff. They generated another, what was it? What did I say there? About $7 million, $8 million, something like that, with long-term stuff, debt. Okay, it looks like it's pretty well balanced now. Let's look at one thing here. I said, notice again, in 2005, I had $13 million in equity money, 1 and 12. You see that? 1 and 12 equity money. And then in 2006, I had 4 and 12. That's $16 million, okay? Now, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to get a little butch and talk about a debt-to-equity ratio. Let's see what this company's balance between debt and equity did. So, this is a rough back of the envelope, and you can do it a little more detailed. I'm just going to take their long-term debt divided by their equity. So if I looked at the 2005 long-term debt, I got 10,784. And then I'm going to divide that by 13 million. Well, that didn't work. What the hell was that? 10,784. And I'm going to divide that by 13 million. Debt equity, about 0.83. Every dollar of owner money has 83 cents of debtor money, more or less. That's the way I think of it. Now let's go to 2006. What do you see? What's the debt equity do? What do you see? What's your debt equity do? You got $15 million in long-term debt in 2006. You got equity of $16 million. What do you see there? What's that? What is it? Went up. Went up to what? What was the final number? 94%. So we had an increase. This company is leveraging somewhat. It's, in a sense, what is happening is that it is chosen now to utilize a little more debt to finance its operations. Now, I think maybe on Tuesday I'm going to show you the phenomenon called gains to leverage. The more debt you use for each dollar, up to a certain point, certainly, but the more debt you use for every equity dollar, the more bang that equity dollar gets in terms of return. That's called the gains to leverage. That's why I always tell you in other finance classes about OPM. And have you ever been told about OPM? Other people's money. Don't use your own damn money. Use other people's money, because that magnifies the return on the little bit that you put in. You put in a lot of yours, you get a little return. You put in a little of yours with a bunch of OPM, other people's money, your return just gets magnified by it. That's what's essentially happening here. This company is moving towards debt to magnify the impact on each dollar of equity. That's what I see here. Now, there might be other things that disabuse me of that, but that's what I see. Notice, by the way, some of the key ratios that I'm looking at. Now, I want to bring up one here called working capital. It's not a ratio. It's just a number. Take your current assets minus your current liabilities. What's your current assets? That's called your working capital. What's your current assets minus your current liabilities? 2005 should get about what? 2.3 mil? Or is it 230,000? Jeez. Current assets, 37 minus current liabilities, 14. Yeah, that's 23. Okay, what's your current liabilities? I'm sorry, what's your 2006 working capital? Did it rise or fall? Let me see. Yeah. You see 21 million? Yeah. A little bit of a fall. Again, that's more evidence of this company tilting towards the long run, moving away from the currency. The working capital has slid, not dramatically, and that's a good news. I would really get worried if working capital dropped a whole lot. The current assets minus the current liabilities. But also what's very comfortable to me here, what's good about this, a good sign here, is that if I were to take the current assets in 2005, 37 million, if I were to take those 37 million and divide them by the current liabilities in 2005, 14 million, I would get a ratio of 2.64, okay? Now, if I go, so in other words, there were a little more than $2.5 of current assets for every dollar of current liabilities. That bothers me a little bit. That's an awful lot of current assets
for the current liabilities. I feel more comfortable when they're closer together. Now, there's some places, businesses, where you have to have the current that ratio high. I just still sticks in my craw a little bit. Now, I go over here and I look at 2006, 30,000 in current assets and 9,000 in current liabilities. That bothers me. You see what happened? Look at it. What do you see? What do you get? What do you get? What was it? 3.3. Yeah, 3.3. So their current assets are pulling ahead of their current liabilities. That sort of bothers me a little bit about that matching principle. The currencies are actually not coming into line, they're coming a little bit more unbalanced. Now, I'd have to look at more years to say, is this a trend or is this just some one-trick pony? You'd have to look at more than this. But with the evidence I've got here, it's an issue. It's just something to talk about. It's a conversation we might have somewhere along the line. Okay, enough. We've got our current, our assets and our liabilities and owner's equity match, so yay for accounting. Oh, there's a cutoff. I wanted to mention. Down there at the bottom where it says the common shares, it cut off 2006. The common shares in 2006 were 4 million. And then, obviously, the only other number that would be different would be the total equity would be 16 million. Okay, so 2006 got cut off there. The 2006 common shares should be 4 million. Par is still a buck. Total common would be then 4 and 1, which would be, I'm sorry, 4 and 3, which would be 4, and so the bottom one is 16. Okay, enough of that. One last thing. Look at your changes. This is how I always recommend you do your get your statement of cash flows. You just plow in there, and remember the things that you're not going to need. The things that you will not need are the cash, because that will come out of the calculation. And then you were certainly not going to want the retained earnings. Okay, so everything else, and, that's weird. But anyway, do the changes as a sidebar column and then just line them up on the statement of cash flows where they go. And you can see in the statement of cash flows, yeah, operations, that's the income, bring back the depreciation. Look at your increases or decreases in receivables, inventories, securities, prepaid expenses, payables, and expenses. Essentially, look at the stuff from the currents. That's your operations. Look at the stuff from the currents, and that's your operations. Don't forget your depreciation. Investments, look at your fixed. Look at your fixed for our purposes. And the financing activities are the total debt issued, the new debt, any proceeds from stock sales, if you paid anything off, debt of any kind off, if you soaked up some of your common stock into the treasury, that would certainly be there. And then you get your cash from operations, from financing, and from operations, investment, and financing. Put those together, and that gives you your total change in your cash balance. In this case, if you look to the bottom line, and again, the accountant would provide you with this stuff. It's not my focus. It's not the focus of a financial analyst to be looking at how this was brought about. What we care about is what we've got there. We care about the steaks, the rump roast, indeed the hamburger. That's what we want out of this. And now I can look at what happened here. Okay, our cash went up $2.7 million. Good news, really good news. Always better to be positive than to be negative. Okay, our operations brought in almost $11 million in cash, new cash, net inflow. We burned up $14 million on new assets. And we brought in
$5 million, almost $6 million from money we've borrowed. So in terms of internally generated equity, we brought in a net of $10.8 million, almost $11 million. And from financing, we pulled in about $6 million, $5.8 million. Other people's money, borrowed and all that kind of stuff, net $5.8 million, about $6 million. From our operations, we were able to bring in about $10.8 million. The problem, though, is that in this statement, I'm a little bit bothered by how the company's, by what the company's doing. But I'm not terribly bothered because it looks like this company is in a serious transitional phase, a growth phase, a maturing phase. But this company spent a whole lot of money, and it definitely brought in a lot of cash from depleting its inventory. It saved itself a lot of money. The reason it's got a lot of cash there at the end, $2.7 million, it depleted its inventories. It got rid of some marketable securities. It paid off some of its boosted its receivables. I didn't mean paid off. It boosted its receivables. It did get rid of some of its payables and all of that. But it bothers me here that it looks to me like this company really, that cash there at the end, $2.7 million that came in net at the end, there's an awful lot of that that was actually the result of OPM, bringing in other people's money to keep this business going. That might very well be logical because, as I said, it's a transition period. And in transition periods, you're going to need more money than your operations are creating. But at the same time, it is something that you have to watch. And as an analyst, you would say, over the next several years, we should be aware that these ratios would best come into a better configuration because it appears right now, from the financial statements that we have in front of us, that this company is generating a considerable amount of its cash from borrowing and equity sales. And it will be to the company's benefit to rely less upon external generation of cash in the future and rely more and more upon the sales of its goods and the timely receipt of the money therefrom. That's how I'd put it. Now, I expect you to say it like that? No. But at the same time, that's how I'd put it, is that I see issues here. I see that this company has burned up an awful lot of its inventory to save cash. In other words, it didn't use cash by buying new inventory. Let's hope that they don't keep doing that to the point where one day they don't have the inventory to sell. And a great example of that, fabulous example of that, is the genius of these, well, we're not going to keep inventory. We're just going to get things made as they are needed. Furniture company here in town, it's nearly knocked itself out of business because people go in to buy stuff on its showroom. Well, we don't sell the showroom stuff. We order it from the factory. Okay, well, how long will that be? Well, it normally is 12 weeks, but it might be as long as 16 weeks to make this piece of... What? They're losing sales right and left because they don't have anything to sell. We make it when you need it. Well, I need it now, butthole. And then when people are tolerant, okay, I'll live with that. Then they find that they're oftentimes not getting their orders. 12 weeks, 16 weeks. Well, we plan to have it to you by Christmas this year. This is actually a true story. And the person said, just cancel the order. Well, you've already put it in. You can't do that. And this person happens to be a lawyer and said, I'm a lawyer. Yes, I can. Oh, okay. So, see, there's only so far you can push that game with just-in-time inventory, leaning your inventory out. It's wonderful, but go into a grocery store. Here's a good example of a grocery store that has very lean inventory, Aldi's. I hate Aldi's. They put your damn food on the floor in boxes, and they say, here's your damn food. They made me pay a quarter so I could have a cart. Security deposit. Yeah, I'm really going to steal one of these carts? Yeah. Disgrace myself walking around, professor, pushing a damn Aldi's cart? Man, they don't pay you guys enough, do they? Well, you know. But you'll see the phenomenon even a little bit at Walmart. Walmart with its low, low prices, you will oftentimes find that there is something that's just not there. It's always what you want. All the other stuff around it's there, but what you want isn't there. But that's what you get for having low, low prices. You stand in very long lines, and usually there's something there that you can buy, but you'd be surprised at how often there is not something that you want there that you really, really need. And so, on the other hand, you can pay more for it and have ample inventory at a place. Go to a place like Schnucks. They've got they got everything you need right there. And they got tons of sliced deli beef and all that kind of stuff ready for you, whether you want it or not. They got all this inventory. So it's a balancing act. How lean can you make your inventory before you start to lose too much in sales because you don't have anything for the customer to buy? Here's a rule. If you want to sell something, have something for the customer to buy right there. Especially a lot of people are still, they want it in their hands. That's why online sales are great, but at the same time, they will never completely replace the brick and mortar store because, do you like to shop?
I like to shop.
I mean,
but I like to go.
Yes. Yes. Put my hand on it, and, you know, try it on. Oh, these are too damn tight. That's right, and that will always be the case. Is that, and in fact, it can get ridiculous. Though in marketing, I've talked about this, and I don't want to bore you with this, but in marketing, we talk about optimal space allocation, especially in women's stores, because you get into a fascinating psychological aspect. Have you ever gone into one of the Okay, guys, I don't want to bring this up to you, but have you ever gone into a women's store where they had the stuff packed so close together that you were sliding behind between the aisles like that? Actually, there's a logic to that. They're intensely using their floor space, but there's a much more much deeper reason. As you have to push yourself between the clothes, you're feeling all of them. Oh, you go to, I've even done it. I've been sliding between these women's racks. Oh, hey, that's nice. But they don't dare do that in guys. Because one of the things we do know about guys is that they do not, first of all, like very close quarters, and they do not want to be too close to another guy. You put the aisles too close together, look at the stores, look at the tools, look at the aisles with the tools. They are wide so that guys are not butt to butt. Because that is something we know. We've actually got good video of guys, they pull like this. Oh man, my cheeks, don't touch. It's just something about it. But so you see, there's a psychological aspect to this inventory management. How intensely can you use the space before you offend a social norm? But intensely using the space can be beneficial if it is to the purpose of getting someone to feel of it or to be forced to look at something that the person might otherwise not have to look at. You have all, I'm sure, been told about the cereal aisle, right? You know about the cereal aisle. Getting blank looks. Look at the way the cereal aisles are laid out. Sugary cereals, low. High fiber cereals, high. You do not want the little kids seeing the high fiber cereals. No, mommy, I don't want that cereal. That cereal makes my colon throb. Yes, mommy, I want that cereal. That cereal makes me bounce off the walls and pee all day. Yes. You see, all of it's about not just the inventory intensity, but the inventory placement. Placement, one of the four P's of the marketing mix. But in this case, and returning to this, I have certainly never seen Acme, the Acme Corporation's storefronts or whatever it does, but there is apparently a drive down in inventory. Are they doing it deliberately? That would be something that I would look. Remember what I told you about the MD&A, the management discussion and analysis? I would damn well better expect them to explain that in there. If they don't say anything about that in there, that scares me. They need to address that. And that's why there's an interaction between the MD&A and the financial statements. And it's not just the numbers. Well, this number was this, this number was this. In that MD&A, if you do explain, give me a good plausible reason, I'll say, cool. We'll keep an eye on it, but that's cool. But if they avoid talking about why their inventory dropped like that, that's a warning signal right there. And here's one of the rules that I gave long ago in financial analysis. Do not blow smoke up my butt and tell me you're having a barbecue in my honor. Okay? Keep that in mind. And then, again, this weekend, I will be down in the computer lab in COB. If you want to come down and look at Edgar's statements, look at some Standard & Poor's reports, great. You'll have this online that you can use in an interactive framework, this financial statement. You'll also have a take-home quiz this weekend. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.